Revealed over the weekend that President Trump objected to the strikes in Syria, with the U.S. now taking center stage in finding a diplomatic solution. From WPFW News, I'm Noah Portner.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
Good afternoon. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Nana Show. I wanted to start by sharing a clip about AOC, who was really pulling a number. This is Caitlin Johnson commenting on AOC's how did she call it? She called AOC a genocidal scam artist, which is really appropriate. And I say this as somebody who actually supported AOC when she was running for elections and soon after, because I thought that she's going to do some good, but now she's running cover for the U.S. government and for the Israeli government. So let's listen to Caitlin Johnson's take, read by Tom Foley.
AOC is a genocidal con artist. The Democratic Party's Instagram-friendly progressive darling, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has voted with the overwhelming majority of House representatives against withholding $500 million in missile funding for Israel, despite previously saying that Israel is committing a genocide of Palestinians in Gaza with U.S. support. The only lawmakers voting to withhold the military aid were Democrats Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Summer Lee, and Al Green, and Republicans Thomas Massie and Marjorie Taylor Greene. Coming under fire from the left for the glaring contradiction of providing military assistance to a state that is perpetrating an active genocide, AOC issued a statement claiming her vote was about protecting civilians. The statement reads as follows. Marjorie Taylor Greene's amendment does nothing to cut off offensive aid to Israel, nor end the flow of U.S. munitions being used in Gaza. Of course I voted against it. What it does do is cut off defensive Iron Dome capacities while allowing the actual bombs killing Palestinians to continue. I have long stated that I do not believe that adding to the death count of innocent victims to this war is constructive in its end. That is a simple and clear difference of opinion that has long been established. I remain focused on cutting the flow of U.S. munitions that are being used to perpetuate the genocide in Gaza. End quote. AOC's statement is absolute crap. The Iron Dome is not used for defending, it's used to facilitate constant attacks. In an article for Jewish Currents titled Iron Dome is Not a Defensive System, Dylan Saba explains, by almost entirely negating the ability of militant groups in Gaza to respond to Israel's incursions, the purportedly defensive Iron Dome allows Israel to strike without fear of repercussion. And because the cost is so low when measured in Israeli casualties, Israel can wage perpetual war without suffering domestic political consequences and is under negligible pressure to pursue diplomacy with the Palestinians. In theory, a weapon like Iron Dome could be used only defensively, but in practice it doesn't work that way, analyst Nathan Troll told Jewish Currents. Iron Dome facilitates greater Israeli offensive measures because it lowers the perceived cost to Israel of escalating or extending or initiating attacks. In other words, when the Iron Dome may prevent the deaths of Israeli noncombatants, it has made it easier for Israel to engage in deadly operations that take Palestinian lives. End quote. The Iron Dome isn't for protecting civilians, it's for protecting the Israeli regime from deterrence. We see this in the comfort the regime displays in waging constant military violence on its neighbors, knowing they can't retaliate. That's why Israel cut a ceasefire deal with Iran so fast. Iran's advanced missile systems can't be reliably stopped by the Iron Dome, so Iran was able to smash Israel and force it to cease its unprovoked aggressions. If Israel had had a missile defense system which could casually swat those missiles out of the sky at a high rate of success, Israel would still be bombing Iran today, and would continue doing so until Tehran looked like Gaza. Israel's war-horny population would have supported this, because they'd have no skin in the game. Saying you support funding Israel's defensive weapons while opposing sending it offensive weapons is as nonsensical as saying you would never give a mass shooter guns and ammunition, but you would give him body armor to keep him safe from the police. You are helping him commit mass murder just as much as you would be if you gave him guns and ammo. Kings didn't arm their knights with shields and armor so that they could live long and fulfilling lives. They did it so the knights would live long enough to kill the people the kings wanted killed. If you believe a state is committing genocide, there is no justifiable reason for you to support enhancing that state's military capabilities and helping it defend itself from those who try to stop it. As others have pointed out, this is exactly the same as opposing Hitler's Holocaust but supporting giving anti-aircraft flak cannons to Nazi Germany. It's a self-evidently ridiculous, warmongering, and ultimately genocidal position, disguised as progressive humanitarianism. It's all the ugliest things about Western liberals. People who say you should criticize AOC less because there are way worse members of Congress act like she's just passively sitting there being a mediocre lawmaker. She's not. She's actively anchoring the leftmost edge of the Overton window of U.S. politics to militarism, capitalism, colonialism, and genocide. She's actively stopping American politics from moving any further left than the nightmare we see before us. Leftists shouldn't hate AOC less than the politicians to her right. They should hate her much more. It isn't Mike Johnson's responsibility to move the U.S. government to the left. And it's not Nancy Pelosi's job. It's hers. That's what she was elected to do. That's what she framed the goals of her entire political career as being. She's taking her stand, firmly bracing against any leftward movement from America's genocidal, warmongering, unjust, exploitative, tyrannical status quo. And that's what she was actually put there to do. Her real job is to say thus far and no further to the leftmost end of the political spectrum of the world's most powerful and destructive government. That's the Democratic Party's job in general, and it's the job of media-savvy progressive Democrats in particular. They are there to provide as little resistance as possible when U.S. politics are shoved toward more genocidal, militaristic, oligarchic, capitalist, imperialist abuses, and to provide as much inertia as possible to any movement in the opposite direction. That's why people who seek leftward movement in the U.S. political machine see AOC as one of their main enemies. It's for the exact same reason you'd see someone actively blocking the fire exit as your enemy when trying to escape from a burning building.
And that was Caitlin Johnson, read by Tom Foley, about the the scam that AOC is trying to pull, as she's done before. Both her and Bernie, by the way, I had actually worked on Bernie Sanders' first campaign because I thought he's going to do some good, and he folded into the Democratic Party, the most unprincipled party that we've had in the history of the United States, more unprincipled than the Republican Party. We're not talking about evils here. We're talking about principles, and the Democratic Party has no principles. And even right-wing pundits like Tucker Carlson and others are coming up and criticizing the aid to Israel, while not a single Democrat besides the people who supported the recent bill, like Rashida Tlaib, had said anything close to what they're saying about the starvation of Gazans right now. And Caitlin Johnson's brilliance is in summing up things very in one sentence. And here she says that AOC is basically saying that, oh, I didn't give him means of offense. I just gave the serial killer or the shooter a bulletproof vest to protect him. And if it wasn't, and she is so right, I would just want to emphasize one point that she made, that if they didn't deplete this Iron Dome that AOC is supporting and afraid to defund, if they didn't deplete their rockets in the Iron Dome, the Israelis, then the war on Iran would have continued till today. But the only reason why they didn't is because they depleted the rockets. And the damage that was done in the interim, when we knew that the rockets were depleted, was to the damage to Tel Aviv was tremendous. So where are we now? We're in the fifth wave right now of starvation of Gaza, which means right now, for a section of the population, not only are people dying of hunger, but even for a section of the population of Gaza, even if they're given food now, they'll have permanent damage in their lives. That's where we stand. That's the barbarism. That's why you have American commentators at this point pointing out that the Israelis have reached the immorality of the Nazis. We have suddenly ruling class people like, well, I mentioned Kallas from the European Union last week, and I have to mention David Lammy of Great Britain, giving lip service now, saying, oh, what's happening is disgusting and it's unacceptable in terms of the starvation of people. But you have British reporters that have been pushing him since October of 2023, telling him that this is what's happening, that you have to believe when the Israelis say when the Israeli government says we're gonna starve, we're gonna cut off the water, and so on and so forth. And we have people openly talking about, in terms of Zionists and specifically leaders of the settlers in Israel, talking openly about creating a concentration camp, which is being built right now. And they don't mince words when they hear it. And they have no shame as people who have ancestors who've survived the Holocaust, just as Holocaust survivors and genocide experts are calling this what it is. A genocide, a massacre. And it's much more, this is way beyond the Holocaust, even in the sense that this is just like the Holocaust. The difference is that this is being broadcast daily and you see it. And those of you who are quiet about it, you are the good Germans. Make no mistake. If you haven't been to a demonstration, if you haven't written your senator or a governor, if you haven't done anything, if you haven't sent money to one of the aid organizations, you are a good German. There's no question. And you think you're safe. You think you're safe. You think this is the quality of life that you're going to preserve by being quiet as an American. Because, well, you're seeing the results right now. The ricochet is pretty intense right now. Because why? Because the American empire is failing. Because the Western empire, the UK, is failing. When the Ottoman Empire was in its last days, they call it the sick man of Europe or Asia. This is the sick man. Our people are sick right now. We just went through a presidency where a Democratic president that can barely finish a sentence was propped up as he repeated nonsensical things. Telling us that he saw things that he didn't see, right? And justifying and answering when he was confronted about the thousands of children that were killed with a smirk. I would love, there can't be justice in this world until Biden and Trump are dragged out to The Hague and put in prison for life. There has to be there can't be justice. If we just stop this right now, and with no consequence to the people that supplied bunker busters to kill women and children and admit to it openly, if these Israeli soldiers that killed women and then put on their dresses and danced around for TikTok, if these people are not brought to justice, thank God that there's organizations like Hind Rajah. But I'm not talking in a vacuum here. I'm talking about that there are organizations working on this, and Israeli soldiers are being identified around the world, and being ar the arrests have started. In Belgium, they already arrested two IDF soldiers when Hind Rajah Foundation pointed them out. So Belgium has just broke the ice, so to speak. When those with these arrests, and secondly, Israeli tourists everywhere are being confronted and kicked out of restaurants and hotels and such. And the most recent incredible action, it was done by Greeks, by who has stopped the cruise ship from docking. On one of the islands, on one of the Greek islands, by lining up hundreds of people across the shore and holding up Palestinian flags and chanting "Free, free Palestine." The ship, the cruise ship, which was filled with Zionists from Israel, had to turn around after the passengers on board raised the Israeli flag and tried to chant to counter the chants coming from the shore, thinking that somehow they'll penetrate that picket line, but they didn't, and they had to turn around. These are the things, these are the consequences. There has to be not just the fact, not just letting aid in, but there has to be consequences to this crime of the century. There's no other description of it, a crime of the century. So with that, I wanted to go to an almost, if I dare to say, an almost poetic rendition of what is happening right now in Gaza in terms of starvation, with the Electronic Intifada interviewing a Gazan on how important even a dried date has become in terms for the starving Gazans. So let's have a listen to that.
I'm Ali Abu Nema here with my colleague Nora Barrows Friedman, and you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. Only people who have lived through a genocide and felt it in their bones can truly understand what it means. The constant fear of death and loss, physical hunger, and yearning to feel safe. Reading news articles and watching videos of the aftermath of Israel's massacres might provide for a basic understanding of the situation we're enduring here in Gaza, but that is not the same as experiencing it with all five of your senses. Those words were written by Asim al-Nabi in his recent piece for the Electronic Intifada titled, Try to Imagine Living in a Genocide. Asim is an engineer, a PhD researcher, and an extraordinary writer living in Gaza City. He also serves as the spokesperson for Gaza Municipality, and we're deeply honored and grateful to welcome him once again to the Electronic Intifada live stream. Welcome, Asim. It's so good to see you.
Yeah, I'm glad to be with you again, Ali and Noura. It's always like a pleasure to be with you, talking about Gaza from Gaza. And also, I would like to express my greetings and also the greetings of Gaza and Palestinian in Gaza to you, to all of you. We really respect and appreciate your efforts to spread the awareness about what is happening here in Gaza. So thank you, and thank you for everyone in your team.
It's our honor, as always.
It really is. And those words mean so much coming from you, Asim. And it pains me to say it, and I'm embarrassed to comment on it, but each time we see you, you look a little bit thinner. And that's the reality expressed in your appearance that so many people in Gaza are facing. And there's no escaping that reality right now. Now, Asim, the Electronic Intifada just published another piece you wrote called Life Without Fuel. In it, you write, of the many means of collective punishment used by Israel against Gaza, more than 2 million people, the fuel blockade, against Gaza's more than 2 million people, the fuel blockade is one of the most devastating and yet least understood. Asim, please help us understand how the lack of fuel impacts life and even the survival of people in Gaza right now who are already facing daily massacres and the ongoing deliberate starvation.
Well, Ali, let me start from the beginning to give a brief about what is the real situation right now in Gaza. While I'm not sure that I can really explain and express what is really happening in the city right now and what we are enduring in terms of food insecurity, water scarcity, massive bombardments, and even the intensive damage to the infrastructure. It is unbelievable, you know, that it's a kind of suffer that people shouldn't really endure to or to live in similar circumstances. And when we talk about the fuel, fuel in Gaza now is like blood for civic services. Since Israel cut off the electricity since October 2023, from the beginning of this attack on Gaza, they stopped the electricity supplies. So now we rely 100% on a fuel to operate the remaining facilities, you know. Israel has destroyed 70% of the total water wells in Gaza. There is more than 100,000 meters in water networks, you know, the damages in water networks. 100% of the sewage pumps and plants in Gaza also got partially or totally damages. More than 200,000 of sewage network also got damages. And those numbers actually only in Gaza City, you know, while, you know, double or triple of these numbers in all Gaza Strip. And 85% of the heavy vehicles also have been destroyed, you know, and in the past 22 months. So we have limited resources right now, and there is a huge need for the civic and for these basic services. And when we talk about basic services, it's like, you know, water, solid waste management, sewage treatment, and open roads, which is closed by because of the rubbles and the damages to facilities and buildings in the city. And to do that, we need fuel. We need fuel to pump water from the remaining wells. You know, we need fuel to treat the sewage. We need, and now we are not treating that. We need fuel just to bomb it to the sea. Otherwise, it will be like a sewage flooding around the city. And that's what we are seeing daily among the city. We can see sewage flooding to tents, to homes, to even to the displacement areas, to schools, to everywhere. So as an engineer at the municipality of Gaza, and as the spokesperson of Gaza, I know fuel is very essential. It's a life-saving need right now, because without the fuel, water can't be pumped, sewage can't be treated, solid waste, now it's already accumulated in every street corner in the city. We are talking about 250,000 tons of solid waste now are accumulated in the city, in Gaza City itself. So, and to be honest, I don't know why they don't allow sufficient amount of fuel just to alleviate the suffering of people. We are not talking about, you know, rebuilding the city, start the reconstruction steps. No, we just need to operate some water wells, some sewage plants and the stations. We need to operate some heavy vehicles to collect the solid waste from the city. We called the NGOs. We called for a real action. We called the UN. We called everyone around the world. You know that. Please let us do our work. We need to do our work. We have great engineers. We have great workers. And we are work tersely just to serve our people who are really, you know, they are living under a very difficult circumstances. They are facing many difficulties every day. As the sun rises, they start to think what to eat, how to feed their kids, how to get to drinking water. So at least we need to provide them some water. We need to collect the solid waste from around their houses and their tents. So fuel is essential right now to alleviate the people's suffering. Without a fuel, the municipalities in Gaza Strip won't be able to do and to provide the minimum needs, you know, that people are asking for now. We tried our best. We tried to do some, initial maintenance for some wells. We used our manual and sometimes we use like an old ways and old equipment to maintain these equipments and to maintain these wells and some stations in the city. But just to sum up, it's a massive and a huge damages in the city, in all infrastructure and civic facilities. The municipality lost the majority of its capacity. We have limited resources now. We don't have sufficient amount of fuel. So the result is what we are seeing right now. It's an environmental and health crisis. People are getting a few amount of water. And in general, when we talk about solid waste accumulating in the city, and when we talk about water scarcity, and we talk about sewage flooding, so that lead to a health crisis. And this is what already the Ministry of Health, they talk about skin conditions, stomach conditions, especially among the children. So again, we need to send and to convey our message again through AI and to everyone that please do something. We need just sufficient amount of fuel to operate the civic facilities right now. And I'm not sure if we have time just to go deeply in this situation, Like, this is regarding the civic facilities, okay? But what about the personal and the individual needs? How do you know how people are cooking right now in the city? There is no gas, there is no fuel, there is no electricity. So they start to burn their box, their clothes, their furniture, the wood, the trees, the sponges, the fabrics. You know, it's like that's lead to environmental crisis. I mean, maybe they will move because of the environment. It's like even the individuals are really struggling because there is a lack of fuel. And yeah, we need to mention about the collapsing of transportation system, collapsing of a food supplies system, the collapsing of communication system. So fuel is affecting actually every single service that we need in our normal life, and especially in a genocide time.
Awesome. It's just, it's so overwhelming. You know, as you say, people, are, you know, as soon as they wake up, it's this struggle just for basic needs and necessities. In your art, in the art, one of the articles that you wrote for us recently, Try to Imagine Living in a Genocide, you write about a suggestion you made to your wife regarding your children who have been living outside Gaza since before the genocide. Tell us what that suggestion is and why you made it.
Yes, I was thinking, and my family were outside of the city before the beginning of the war. And now it's almost it's already 2 years since I didn't meet them yet. I really miss my wife Islam, my son Iyad, and my daughter Furat. I really miss her, especially Furat. But also I want them to know that their father and their wider family and the people in Gaza are really struggling, you know. And that's why my wife and I tried to explain to them what is happening. But recently I suggested here that, what about you let them, the two kids, to use only limited amount of water to understand what is water scarcity means. So, because I want them to really understand, observe what is water scarcity, you know, because I can't tell you numbers and statistics, data, numbers, and the statements will give you a basic understanding, but it won't give you a deep understanding about what is the big terms means, water scarcity, food insecurity, starvation. But do you really understand what that means? And it's not a call for guilt, you know. I love my kids. I want them to enjoy their life, you know. I'm not blaming them for because they are not here in Gaza, you know. But I believe imagination could lead to a real understanding. And real understanding would lead to a bold actions. And bold actions will, of course, lead to effective results. And that's what we need. Because as someone live in the city, 2 years, almost 2 years of genocide, I want that to be stopped. You know, I want an end for the genocide. So I thought every day, I'm thinking every day that what people, what my friends around the world should do, you know, because I also wrote in EI an article that don't ask me what should we do or what should people do, okay? Because it's your duty to figure out what to do, okay? So this is another step, you know, that you need to understand. You need to really understand, because you can just watch videos and check reels, but you won't understand what is the starvation means, and you can't feed your kids, and your children losing weight, crying from hunger. So you need to imagine what that. And just let me do something. Imagine this. There is a man in Gaza today, wake up in the early morning, had no breakfast, walked to his work. He's working for 650 days right now with no salary and no day off, in a high-risk working area. Then he got plain rice for his lunch. Then he needs to walk from a place to another place where his family yesterday just evacuated from a displacement area to another displacement area, you know, because there is an evacuation order from the Israelis. Then he came back again to a place with no electricity. His phone battery is going to die, and he has a small battery, so he ran his internet connection, doing an interview, and of course he won't have a dinner tonight. This is me, okay? And I consider myself lucky because I can get a daily meal. I can charge my phone and my laptop once a day. I have access to the internet. At least my family, they split apart into two groups yesterday. So I need, and my father and some of my family members in a place, and my mother with some other family members in another place. But at least we have places to go. We know, you know, I know where are they. So I consider myself lucky. So imagine that. Imagine this is just a flash to one day. Yesterday, I survived, you know, a deadly strike. It was like only 100 meters away from me. So it's like, again, I need to repeat it. It's not a call for guilt. I knew my message was for our supporters and our friends around the world, that please do something from a deeper understanding, you know? So, I wish that I explained myself, because a lot of my friends sent me that it was great, but in the beginning I thought that, it's, oh no, I don't want people to feel bad about themselves. The main objective of the article is to encourage people to do something.
Yeah.
Not that it was.
And you expressed that very clearly in the article, and you gave the examples of other solidarity actions that people have taken, including fasts and hunger strikes, in order to not to experience what you're experiencing, because that's impossible, but to just have some connection between their body experiencing something that can help them to understand in a way that reading statistics can't. I thought it was a really beautiful piece and a beautiful way to seek that deeper understanding and to continue to encourage people, which is what we're always trying to do, to take action and visible action, to express solidarity, to express their support for people in Gaza, to express their rejection of the normalization of this genocide. That is so important now, and even more so now. We'll talk about that later as well. With Asim, I want to point to this photo that you posted on social media a week ago, of a date, one date next to a ruler. What is this date here? Tell us about this.
It's just a date, you know, Ali. It's just a date, a 4-centimeter date. But I kept it for 6 months, and I used to say myself that for the darkest days, you know, and the darkest days are here right now. And I love dates. Arabs like dates, and I love dates, you know, and my mother loves dates too. So after 6 months, when I get it, I decided to give it to my mother. The next day, she told me that she passed it to my daughter, to my sister Nisma. Nisma was born in 2008, so she survived 2008, 2012, 2014, 2019, 2021, and she's a survivor so far. She is 17 years now. She's studying for her secondary school without teachers, without electricity, without internet, just some old books. And I believe she is genius, you know. So my mother decided to pass that date to Nisma because she believes that she needs it. She needs some, you know, some sugar, some snacks, you know, during her study. The Nisma decided to pass that date to my nephew, Mu'min. This boy is 2 years old, and he was born just 2 months before the war, and he lost his father, Mu'taz Rajab, a 37-year-old gentleman, postgraduate economist and researcher. So this boy didn't know what is a date mean, you know? So Nisma gave it to Mu'min. Then I thought about, it's like, you know, it's just a date. We shouldn't take these decisions, you know, just to eat a date. And then and that's where I start to think about, we love each other. We really love each other, you know. And there is a lot of good in the city, among the people. Maybe the war might lead, you know, to some bad actions from some people, which is, I really understand, you know, it's a genocide. We can't blame people for some actions. But overall, I like to see good things in the people. And that's what I really notice, you know, that people are really understand each other and they support each other. And this date is like a symbol of love. And I just took that picture. I don't know how I realized that I wanted to measure the length of that date, you know, but then, but it's for me very precious because I kept it for 6 months, give it to my mother bought it to my sister gave it to my nephew. And it's only one event happened in Gaza, but every day we saw examples that Palestinians deserve to live. Palestinians deserve to live in peace. The ones to do good for themselves, for their city, for their homeland, and even for the world civilization. So give us that a chance, you know. Maybe some people will say it's just a date. Yes, it is just a date, but there is a lot of meaning in this date. I hope our supporters and our, you know, friends around the world that can catch my idea in this post.
Mm. It's extraordinary, awesome, that nobody wants to eat the last date. Nobody wants to. Yeah. To deprive someone else of it. Do you think Nesma will, is it, am I allowed to ask if Nesma will eat it? I know everyone wants her to eat it, maybe because she's the, I don't know if she's the youngest, but I know people give everything for those they love.
Of course. Nesma is my youngest sister, right? And we believe she is a genius girl and a war survivor, you know. She can speak three languages. I don't know if there is anyone can beat her in mathematics and physics. She wants to be a doctor to help her people. I know she will do it. I believe that she will survive this genocide. She's a survivor. She survived, you know, 17 years without electricity, without, you know, with nothing. But also I feel sad about her. Like a young girl in her age should go to her school, enjoy, you know, the trip to the school with her friends, going out, maybe travel abroad, getting some experiences. Not a genocide, of course. But also I believe that this sacrifice and these kind of sacrifices would lead to better results. I wish that, you know, because we paid a precious price just to get our freedom and our self-determination. And we believe that our starvation, our blood is might lead the people and the world leaders to take some decisions and actions to change the situation here in Palestine. We are enduring and struggling for 78 years, actually for a century, you know, it's not only 78 years. And I wish Nesma will live in a better, you know, time. I wish she can study medicine as she wants and to eat dates without count them. And the need to pass her only date to her nephew. That's my hope.
I think that's all of our hope for you and your family and everyone in Gaza who deserves the world. Assam, how are you feeling now? I mean, this genocide has lasted for 21 months. How, what keeps you going? And what can you say about your own personal internal universe right now?
Look, it's okay. I feel that I might be killed in any moment. This is that feeling is, you know, chasing me in the past few months, and I can't take it, you know, out of my mindset and my thoughts. And obviously, everyone in Gaza is feeling the same, that I might be the next victim. Me or one of my family and my friends might be the next victim, the next martyr. But this is not the scariest emotions, you know? What is the scariest part is, the scariest part is that you know, and I know, and everyone knows that there is an army and a government in the 21st century in a free world that could kill any civilian for nothing, for no reason. This is the scariest part, that we are living in a time where killing children is fine. You know, can you imagine that? While starving, starvation for civilians is okay. Like, where the hell are we living, you know? That make me feel bad, you know? It's a harmful feeling, a harsh feeling to everyone. I just imagine what does that mean to someone to live in this world, that he might be killed any time. And I know, you know, Israel doesn't need a reason to kill someone or any justification to kill any Palestinians. You know, they killed us for years, for decades now. So, but also I feel optimistic because we are a freedom seekers, you know, we are a freedom seekers. We tried our best. We really tried our best. And I always remind myself about what my close Rifat, my close friend Rifat, my teacher, Dr. Rifat, he once said, if I must die, let it bring hope. I also say the same, but also I add, if I must die, let it bring hope. If I must die, let it bring resistance. If I must die, let it bring revolution. If I must die, let it bring freedom, justice, liberation, peace. Because I'm not going to die for nothing, you know. My people are not dying for nothing. Yes, I feel sad about myself. I feel sad about my people, about my family, but also I feel sad about the people. You know, if there is cancer in a body, you have to stop it or you will be die. So the world has to stop this cancer before it kill everyone, you know. I can't stop myself think about that, you know. It's a harmful feeling, actually, you know, that you know that you will lose your you know, life in a second, and just strike. Maybe the AI will decide to kill you or not. So when you ask me about my feeling, that's my feeling, that I know that I might be the next victim, but at the same time, I still stick to my freedom. I still call for my freedom, and that's our main objective right now, to stand tall in front of Israel and to say no to them loudly and loud as much as we can, because there is no other choice. Unfortunately, there is no other choice.
Awesome. It's difficult to listen to you. And I don't think there are many words I can offer you that that lessen the reality and the truth of the words you've spoken. Or I don't want to say lessen them, but lighten the weight. The only thing I can say is that we've heard what you've said, and you from Gaza have renewed our commitment and our strength and our promise.
You were just listening to the Electronic Intifada interview with a Gazan engineer that is starving now. Unfortunately, his family had already gone, but I can't add anything to this kind of description of the state of things, where a dry date becomes such a precious thing for people suffering from famine. This week will be a week of international or what's called global action for Palestine. Yesterday there was a demonstration in front of the State Department that Code Pink and Palestinian youth movement heeded the call. That was basically, this call came obviously from Palestinians themselves, obviously to ring the alarm bells that famine has set in and it's already killing women and children and men. And as the world stands by, as Western leaders give lip service without lifting a finger to alleviate these conditions. We'll see you next week on Wednesday with the Shai Nana Show. This is Zain Lamine signing off.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Palestinian officials are condemning world inaction as Gaza starves. Mustafa Barghouti, the General Secretary of the Palestine National Initiative, urged an international hunger strike today until world bodies act to stop the starvation, as some 20 Palestinians have died of starvation so far this week.
What is happening in Gaza is a horrific crime with no parallel in modern times. All the red lines have been crossed. Three war crimes are taking place simultaneously: genocide, ethnic cleansing, and collective punishment, including starvation and a devastating famine. We are issuing a message on behalf of civil society organizations. The world is falling short, and so are the Arab and Islamic circles. What is needed is the imposition of sanctions immediately on this Israeli system and this criminal regime.
More than 100 aid agencies have issued a joint statement warning mass starvation is spreading. Starvation in Gaza has also sparked the first of its kind protests in Israel's capital, with attendees holding empty bags of flour and large images of the emaciated dead bodies of Palestinian children in Gaza, reminiscent of victims of the Holocaust. U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff plans to head to Rome for talks with an Israeli official as the U.S. tries to broker a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. The U.S. plan calls for a 60-day truce during which Hamas would release some hostages, Israel would free Palestinian prisoners, and allow a surge of humanitarian aid into Gaza. Peace talks have been ongoing for weeks with no action. The United Nations top court said today countries that fail to take measures to protect the planet from climate change could be in violation of international law. In a landmark case about national obligations to tackle the climate crisis and the consequences they face if they don't, Judge Iwasawa Yuji is president of the court.
The duty of states to cooperate for the protection of the environment is a rule whose customary character has been established.
The non-binding opinion runs over 500 pages. The court ruled a clean, healthy, and sustainable environment is a human right. It's seen as a potential turning point in international climate law. Its ruling paves the way for legal actions, including states returning to the high court to hold each other to account, as well as domestic lawsuits. It's led by the Pacific Island nation of Vanuatu and backed by more than 130 countries. Delegates from Ukraine and Russia are to meet in Istanbul today for a third round of peace talks. Ukraine's president is also calling for face-to-face talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin, since the last two rounds of talks went nowhere. Meanwhile, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky signed a bill that critics say will weaken the nation's anti-corruption agencies. It sparked the first large-scale anti-government protest since Russia's war in Ukraine. Among the critics are the European Union, which Ukraine is seeking membership membership in. Zelensky has defended the law, claiming it removes Russian influence and accelerates stalled corruption cases. The House of Representatives is leaving Washington early as Republicans clash over the Jeffrey Epstein files. The files of the accused pedophile and convicted sex trafficker, House Speaker Mike Johnson is rebuffing pressure to act on the investigation into Epstein as some Republicans push for a vote on the matter.